Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Finally, sunscreen worthy of your skin. Sol de Janeiro's new Rio Radiance SPF 50 collection, where glowing hydration meets sun protection in a beachy and nostalgic set. Confidently embrace your glow with lightweight 100% mineral SPF body lotion, refreshing SPF body spray, and shimmering SPF body oil. Receive 10% off on your first order on soldejaneiro.com, plus free shipping with the code Spotify10.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. And more importantly, today I get to speak with Dr. Lavanya Vemsani, who is a professor at Shawnee State University. We'll be speaking about a brand new 2022 Bloomsbury publication entitled Hinduism in Middle India. The subtitle is Narasimha, the Lord of the Middle. Lavanya, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Raj. Thank you for having me here. I'm really thrilled and honored to be here.
The honor is all ours. The podcast is becoming quite the meeting place for our field. So I'm delightful to see it fructify in the world. You've been a busy beaver since last we've spoke, churning this book out. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of this book.
This book was in the making for a long time. As many of our colleagues know, I have written a lot about Narasimha, and I grew up in Andhra Pradesh, which is the place associated with Narasimha. I call it the Leela Stali of Narasimha because the incarnation and stories of Narasimha are placed here. I would say it's been with me for a long time. I visited many of the temples as a young child and a young person. Presented a number of articles and written about it. I have presented at AAR, at AAR Atlanta. There was, you know, I spoke about good and evil in the Hindu tradition. Of course, Narasimha, you know, shows this big division between the good and evil and their representation. So the story had been with me for a long time. I had worked on it for a long time, its association with prehistory and its connection to the locale of Middle India, the Madhya Desha, only came to me after a lot of research. Initially, it was not obvious, doesn't really occur when you see the stories and study them. So it's been with me for a long time, but the central theme gradually dawned on as I worked on it more and more.
So as many listeners will no doubt be aware, Narasimha is one of the most famous of the often 10 avatars of Vishnu, the man lion incarnation, and there's the story of Prahlada and Hiranyakashipu, and it's a fascinating myth cycle. Let's first talk about what you're studying. Are you primarily studying text? Are you studying a myth cycle? Are you studying religion on the ground? You know, what is the primary focus of the book, would you say?
I would say it's a comprehensive examination of all of the above. You know, for a long time, Narasimha had been studied in silos. You know, there is an examination of text, there is an examination of practice, folk arts. There is an examination of, you know, temples, but they haven't been brought together. So this book, I actually try to bring all of this together because comprehensive examination of multiple sources is important to understand the origin and the evolution of religion in India. If we keep them separate, if we keep practice, folk genre and classical texts separate, it's only going to give us haphazard understanding of religion in India. So that's what happened with Narasimha. So in order to, you know, bring a complete understanding of religion in Middle India as well as Narasimha, I examine all of these three together.
And so just to clinch it for the audience, the three are classical texts. And the
popular practices, you know, the practices that you would see in temples like Tirunalu and holy days and all that, theater festivals associated with Narasimha, and the folk arts, the Oggu Katha, Hari Katha, the folk storytelling traditions. So classical story. Folk storytelling tradition and practices, the theater as well as the fasting and temple practices.
It's fascinating that at this point, first of all, I mean, it's a fascinating and important methodology, I think, to dovetail what we see in texts with obviously what we see on the ground. But it's so interesting that in these times, the classical narratives, you know, for example, the Puranas are classical narratives, part of the classical corpus. But at some point, they would have been, you know, some 15-ish centuries ago, you know, the Puranas are moving targets, as we well know. They would have been folk narratives that folks would have been so forced to pay attention to because of their vibrancy and their life of practice that some smart pundits came together and said, hey, let's give these folk tales proper Sanskrit text, shall we? So I find it so fascinating that the once right. folk narratives that were assimilated as the Puranic narratives, where we see the story of Narasimha, they're now canon, and we have to look at, you know, even more folk narratives.
Right. So exactly as you said, you know, all of our classical texts are also oral texts at some point in time. Including the Vedas. Our classical texts and our practices are not written on the paper. They were actually written in the minds of the people, the minds of dedicated people who could remember and recollect and pass them on. So calling it, you know, classical genre and folk genre sometimes, you know, seems a bit of, you know, oxymoron because, you know, everything was oral. Everything was popular. Everything was recollected by, you know, people who can remember. So the classical genre, of course, you know, was set to writing early on. That's the only difference. And the folk genre is set to writing a little bit later. And in between, we have these archaeological sources, the temples, the sculptures, the, you know, the early, which shows the continuity of the stories from the classical to the folk tradition. So we have this background of, you know, sculptures and all these things. And practices, of course, the practices come to us from the classical texts. You know, the classical Upanishads also include Narasimha Vratam and all that. So,
is this the first such in-depth study on Narasimha?
I would think so. I'm as far as I know, I have researched all the work that is available on Narasimha up to this point. There is classical work done by Biardo and Cypher, and there is popular genre work done by Emig and Eva Borek. But other than that, there is very little work done on Narasimha and very little done on bringing together all these different genres together. So I would say this is the first comprehensive work on Narasimha, trying to bring together and trying to understand exactly what happened and how the historical development of Narasimha happened throughout history, at least more than 2 millennia old. Because we have an early sculpture of Narasimha datable to Vaishali. The Vaishali excavations are dated between 600 BCE to 300 BCE. But you know, in those days, the excavators gave different layers. So Hinduism is always given a little bit later layer. So the 600 BCE is considered to be Buddhist, and the later layer is kind of considered to be Hindu. 300 BCE, but I would really like to give it a little bit early period, because you know, we have found inscriptions and data from 400 BCE onwards on Krishna and Vaishnavism, Vishnu in Vaishali region. So I would say Narasimha, the seal that was found should be dated to 400 BCE, to the beginning of Vaishnavism. So that tells us that you know, the practice has at least been consistent right from the beginning of early Vaishnavism, the 400, 500 BCE, if not earlier, because the Vedic references put it a little bit earlier. But the actual temple or seals or this evidence comes from 400 BCE onwards.
What's the primary argument of the book?
The primary argument?
Argument, gist, thrust, aim, objective. You know, this is not a conference. We're not at the AAR Madison, where, you know, where I may accost you with a very specific question and expect a response. I'm teasing, you know, in a conversational manner. You know, what is the book primarily hoping to accomplish?
Right. The central and our central objective of the book is we have to study Middle India because it holds a lot of historical data. That's what I do here. And the central information that comes from Middle India, the Madhya Desha, also provides us information about the historical development of Hinduism, which goes against the assumed notions of invader versus indigenous. In India, as it happened with the colonial regime, as Britishers began, history was hijacked and this new theory was introduced, where everything is analyzed with the point of invader versus indigenous. So the invaders came in and of course, you know, killed most of us and imparted the new religion and new information to us. A few of the survivors, even though there is no evidence for it, there are no huge mass graves or no huge stories on how these massacres might have happened or invasions have happened. This becomes the central argument of studying anything related to India. But when we study Narasimha, we have a clear continuous origin from historical sources. From 600 BC onwards, we have this historical evidence. And from Neolithic and Paleolithic period onwards, we have lion depictions, and Vedas, of course, have descriptions of lion, the roaring lion, and the lion that was, you know, going on the mountains. And we also have information about the Namuchi story, where Namuchi was killed without using the weapons. So both the themes of lion is there, and killing a demon without using weapon is there in the Vedas. And we also find this continuity in the historic sources. The prehistoric caves, of course, have a lot of lion depictions. Some of them are, so similar to what we see now, the sitting lion or standing lion. Some of the depictions that we see in Padampur are Simhachalam, the depictions of Narasimha appear very similar to these prehistoric depictions of the standing lion or sitting lion. So there is a historical continuity of themes and ideas, even though practice comes from 600 BC onwards. This helps us understand the indigenous origin of religion, indigenous practices, indigenous development of religious practices within India, and then how, right from the beginning, as you mentioned, everything was oral, right? Even the Vedas were oral. So all this actually comes from the embedded practice of a civilization that was here for a long time, for a millennia or more, for a long time, for 5 millennia or more. So the examination is to examine the stories of Narasimha, but the secondary objective is to understand the religion, how the understanding of Central or Middle Indian religion might contribute to the understanding of evolution of religion in India, and how this might be counter to the assumed notions of Indian religion in terms of invader versus indigenous, which doesn't seem possible in this case. Because the ethnic, the tribal notions are still part of Narasimha, which is a reminder of the prehistoric Paleolithic, Neolithic religion in this region.
Which specific regional phenomena do you study?
I study the middle India. The middle, I actually take Telangana, Andhra Pradesh as the middle, central. But I also take the states that flank this region. Orissa, Maharashtra, Chhattisgarh, and Karnataka, because they also have a lot of information. The original stories of origin and activities are connected with Andhra Pradesh and Telangana, but reincarnations of Narasimha and visits of Narasimha to different regions is found in Maharashtra, Chhattisgarh, Orissa, and Karnataka. So it's the central region and then the regions that flank it. So it's the Madhya Desha of India.
What would you say if you could summarize or generalize, what would you say is the primary theme or work of the Narasimha myth cycle?
If you're taking the, so there are two aspects here. That's what I discuss here. The theological, the cosmogonic, the Hindu understanding of the relations between the divine world and the human world. And the second one is historical. So I will discuss first the religious world.
The world within the text, the sort of what's right. Happening, and then tell us about the world behind the text.
Right. So the history, and the first I'll discuss this cosmogonic understanding and the cosmology of Hinduism, and second I'll go with history. So the cosmology of Hinduism has numerous worlds. The universe, the Hindu universe, is made up of numerous worlds, Earth is in the center. There are three worlds beneath us, three worlds above us. And most importantly, the world of gods is above us, and the world of evil is below us. So the crux of the story is, when Hiranyakashipu ruled, he had a special boon from Brahma that, you know, he won't have a death by any weapons or anything. You know, he has these special clauses that he requested and then inducted into his death. But on the other hand, the world. So once he has all these special boons given to him, he becomes immutable. And then he reverses the world order. The reverses the world order means he actually inverted the world order, which means the world of gods went down and the world of evil went up. So he's above the human world and he's ruling the world. But when the axis is upturned, when the axis is overturned, what happens is the time doesn't move forward, it moves backward. So when he turned it, the world began moving backward. So instead of going forward, as in the kalpas, the kalpa, you know, and yugas, it actually started moving back. So the moving back is actually not good. So the story involves these two themes, the time and the space. The space and time, both of them are connected and form a continuum. When one is overturned, the other is overturned. So when the world is overturned, the time is overturned. Instead of moving forward, it's moving backward. Of course, there is discussion on this. The discussion also involves Vishnu taking up this Narasimha, which is a form that doesn't belong to any living being or divine being, and which is also not part of any of these worlds. So he is outside of this cosmological or cosmogonic world. So he's Vishnu outside of this. And when he is killing Hiranyakashipu, he was not just killing Hiranyakashipu. He was turning the world back into its original axis, and he was also turning the time back on its actual path. So he becomes, the special point here is, he becomes Shiva. Only Shiva is the one who can turn the time. Shiva is the controller of time. That's why he's called Mahakala, Kala, and end of time and all that. So Vishnu, by becoming Narasimha, he assumes the qualities. He takes the qualities of Shiva by being outside of this creation, the universe, and then upturning the world, returning it to the order, and also turning time back on its path. So he's setting the clock right, you know, that's what it was. So Narasimha, of course, appears as Narasimha, and then, you know, he takes advantage of the boon and all that. But there is deep theological and symbolic meaning to it on how Hinduism understands the world and its continuity within the divine world.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Always. That's where I live. This is where I live. This is where my house is. The deep, implied, assumed, baked in you know, tomes and tomes of knowledge and philosophy that's encoded in something simple as, you know, a symbolic entity. There's so much there. There's so much there. And also, of course, it's open to interpretation, but it's extraordinarily rich. Just very briefly, you know, as much as you've looked at the narrative, I looked at it to translate it for what did I just publish? Oh, The Stories Behind the Poses.
Right.
And so for one of the poses it's connected with this avatar of Vishnu, I look at it. It's a fascinating story. Could you say something about, at the risk of putting words in your mouth, or words in the mouth of the myth makers, about liminality in this story?
Right.
About you know, sort of neither here nor there, about, you know, Sandhi, you know, twilight, like, say something about that. For those of you who haven't heard the story, there's this really interesting clause where, you know, ancient trope, common trope of demons always look for immortality. They can't have it because the god stole it, or you know, owned it, whatever you want to say. And so they always figure, well, I will find the one clause that will keep me alive forever. You know, may no man or beast be able to kill me. And then a female form comes, and then someone becomes smarter. And this is the best one ever. It's like, okay, I want this boon that I cannot be killed by day or by night, indoors or outdoors. Yeah. And what are the other clauses?
Neither wet nor you know, dry. Neither inside nor outside.
Neither on the earth nor in the air, type thing. And so enter Narasimha. And so, right. So what do you see is happening here? What is this driving at?
Right. So as you said, the earlier scholars have noted the liminality theme here. And Deborah Seifer, who has worked on Vamana Narasimha, actually explored the theme of liminality. But she connects this liminality to bhakti. She considers bhakti as liminal state. But the theme hasn't helped us really go farther into the story of Narasimha. It's not me. The earlier scholars have said, you know, we tried to examine this. You know, she said she used the loophole in the law. That's what suggested to her, and she used it and found it not useful. And then she used the liminality theme, which is useful to understand the bhakti, but not the story or the theology or theogony associated with Vishnu, because it goes beyond the apparent oppositions. As we talked, right? You know, it has this overturning axis, and it has this overturning time. So the themes extend far beyond this idea of liminality. Of course, liminality is central to the evil, the guy Hiranyakashipu. But when we are looking at the divinity and cosmology, the central theme is the time and space, the continuity of time and space, and then how it can be abrupted through some evil deeds or evil actions. So it is more about, you know, having this harmony, having the balance between the good and the evil, between, you know, the seeming opposites. The seeming opposites are part of creation, part of the universe, but when they fall out of balance, it's not going to be a good balance. It's going to cause chaos within the time cycle as well as within the organization of the space. Within the organization of the universe. So that's where I also stop with the liminality theme, with the association of evil and with the association of Hiranyakashipu. and explore further on Narasimha and history within this book.
I'll say a bit more about that, about the historical process.
The historical process is clear in the story of Narasimha because lion and lion themes predominate prehistory. And the tribes in modern practice, the tribes that have kept up with the prehistoric Paleolithic life practices, this is the ethnographic studies actually found that many of the tribes found in this region, the Chenchus and Korns, many of these tribes that are associated with Narasimha, actually still practice many of the lifestyles that were part of Paleolithic, Mesolithic life, the fishing, the hunting, and many of the styles and many of the equipment they use. You know, the fishing hooks or fishing things are still the same as some of the prehistoric equipment that was excavated in this region. This region also has, Ahobilam is not very far from some of the sites, Paleolithic sites excavated, Paleolithic, Mesolithic sites excavated in this region. Jwalapuram actually has a number of sites that give this early evidence. And Jwalapuram is very important because of these prehistoric lifestyles that continue with the tribes and prehistoric habitations that were excavated here. And the second thing that is important is during the prehistory, you know, Paleolithic has three phases, Upper Paleolithic, Middle Paleolithic, and Lower Paleolithic, right? The Upper Paleolithic is the transition period between Paleolithic period and Mesolithic period. And during this period, during the Upper Paleolithic period, historically, the human beings, the anatomically modern human beings, actually replaced the older human beings that were already living across the world. So the history draws that, you know, the early beings that were living here that replaced the anatomically modern humans that replaced the people here. The Chenchus still have the earliest genetic evidence within them. So it's traced, you know, the male genetic heritage traces to C and female genetic heritage traces to M, but both of them trace to this period, 80,000 years ago. And that's when this Jwalapuram and all these habitations between 80,000 to 40,000 years ago, and the religion preserves a number of information from that. During this period, when this replacement happened, when this recovery happened, there was this Toba volcanic eruption that's dated to 74,000 years ago. And the Toba volcanic eruptions, you know, the volcanic ash and all these things are found in Jwalapuram. Jwalapuram actually has a layer that has these Paleolithic hand axes and all those embedded in the volcanic ash. And then you would see the next layer of settlements. And Narasimha is not far from that region. So the recollection of these stories, right? You know, the reversal of time, the fire, and then, you know, Vishnu appearing as fire and the world ending and then restarting again. These images preserve kind of a calamitous time within the human memory. And the story, of course, continues, but historical evidence shows the calamitous evidence of volcanic eruption and these fire, and that saw almost the end of humanity. And the story also remembers it. And the people that lived in this area, the Chenchus who draw themselves to be a closer associates of Narasimha, also keep these lifestyles, the lifestyles that are noted here, the Mesolithic fishing and the equipment that was used. So it seems that the story is recollecting something much more than what we give it credit for. It probably recollects some of these early historical evidence. And some historians actually thought, because these tribes have preserved Narasimha religion, Narasimha totem, you know, the images are drawn and all that, the cones and chenchus, they thought it's tribal religion that was assimilated later by Hinduism. But what comes first, right? You know, the Narasimha is seen already, and Narasimha, of course, is gradually evolving here to be part of the religion that was evolving in India during this time. So if we consider that tribes have kept prehistoric lifestyles, can we also consider that they have kept prehistoric religious practice? And this is one of those prehistoric religious practices that was evolved and that was preserved within the memory and within the texts in Hinduism. So that's the central question we come to when we examine the historical evidence in this region. And it seems appropriate to me to connect these things.
Well, certainly a fascinating and potentially provocative line of thought. There's certainly a lot there. Have you seen this sort of line of argumentation elsewhere, drawing on such ancient, pointing to so long a line of religious transmission? Have you seen something similar in our field, or was this inspired by work elsewhere, or was it just a virtue of what you had come across in your research?
I would say it's an accidental discovery, but that's not by virtue of, you know, anything. That's because in India, all these subjects are kept in silos. Archaeology works in silos. We don't use archaeological data when we are studying the texts. And anthropology is in another silo by itself. We don't use ethnographic understanding. You know, the Chenchus and they're using this prehistoric practices is not studied by us. It's only studied by ethnographers and anthropologists. And archaeologists, of course, they record all these things, you know, the ash, volcanic ash, and all these stone axes that are embedded in the volcanic ash. But we don't take all those evidence into consideration when we are talking about our texts and we are talking about this invader versus indigenous. We are, you know, all working in silos. The literary studies is one silo, anthropology is one silo, and then archaeology is another. You know, we don't know anything about archaeology. We don't use any information from there. As I told you, it's an accidental discovery to put them all together. But putting them all together, I think, is important. The evidence is there for this indigenous development and indigenous origin of religion and culture within India, because there is no evidence for anybody coming in and occupying. The archaeology, for example, it showed this volcanic ash and all that, right? All historical events are actually preserved within the settlements. So if some foreign race came in and occupied, there should be mass graves and there should be new occupation levels. Anytime new people occupy, they impose new line of thought and new practices. So there should be new pottery, new cultural equipment, and new thought. But that kind of abrupt division is not found in texts, not found in the archaeological settlements anywhere they were excavated. Almost 5,000 sites across India are excavated. But no evidence of any forceful occupation or new cultural levels are found in any settlements anywhere. If we examine these archaeological sources closely with classical and practices, social and ethnic practices, probably we will find more evidence for understanding how religion and cultural practices developed within India. We haven't done that so far because we are working in silos. We are all working in silos with all our different subject areas. We haven't brought it together. Bringing it together is important. That's what I have done in this book. It's studying Narasimha, but also bringing together a number of sources and disparate information to understand the evolution of religion in India.
I could pan out for a moment to follow that line of thought, how might this be done differently then? So for scholars in the field, how might we go about, you know, for the sake of argument, not being so siloed, do you think?
When we find a text, when we find a practice, when we find it closely associated with a social group, it's important for us to look at the social group, their practices, and also look at the historical evolution in that area, instead of just making an argument that, you know, oh, these are the tribes, these people have the totem of lion, so this is tribal religion. So is it tribal religion or is it prehistoric religion? How old could this be? Does their lifestyles show anything that indicates that it might be a prehistoric practice that stayed with them, just like their lifestyle and other practices? Can we just call it tribal, or should we call it, you know, prehistoric? So we have to be cautious in understanding every evidence that we come across. And also, I'm a little bit concerned about the use of the word tribal aborigine, and I avoid using this word. India recognizes different lifestyles, and forest lifestyle is also one of the lifestyles recognized in India, and they are called Vanavasi. So I use the term Vanavasi in the book rather than tribal or aborigine, because both of these terms have really, really difficult colonial leanings, colonial oppression in India. Many of the rebellious tribes, even though they're not really tribes, they are, you know, called rebellious tribes or, you know, criminal tribes, and they were categorized as barbaric and categorized as tribes in colonial times. So using the term tribe itself is problematic in India, especially in light of the category that was invented by the British, the criminal tribes, and adding numerous groups to it. It's a haphazard addition, not really Vanvasi. You know, the Vanvasi is a lifestyle. People live on hunting and food gathering lifestyle. The Vanvasi lifestyle is a well-known lifestyle in India.
What sort of subfields or scholars or folks do you think the book might be of most interest to?
It's aimed at history and history of religion. History of religion is, of course, taking new paths. We are expanding. As you know, we are incorporating more and we are studying more ethnography, and we are studying the folk genres and folk tales more than we did in the past. In the past, we just focused on Sanskrit and classical stories, but we are bringing things together. We are expanding into all these fields now. So this will be useful for researchers and students of history, history of religion, and history of India in general. You know, the India, the theory of invader versus indigenous is, of course, you know, a constructed theory, but more and more evidence is, you know, bringing new evidence for this. So it's important for anyone trying to understand India, but especially important for anyone focusing on history of religion.
Was there anything that particularly surprised you or stuck out in your mind or struck you through this research?
The most surprising thing is this prehistoric evidence. You know, the prehistoric evidence actually stood out. And examining these tribal practices, and should we call it prehistoric practice or tribal practice, and reading more on it, and trying to understand these excavations and the early evidence, the Paleolithic, Mesolithic evidence, and the continuation of lifestyles, that was a real surprise. And as I told you, it's an accidental discovery that, you know, this might be connected to that. So That surprise I had.
Because is there anything else?
Studying it, you know, as you know, we are used to studying it as assimilation and indigenous versus invader versus indigenous. So this actually helps put it in a bigger picture perspective and gives us a clear understanding of historical evolution. So that was the biggest surprise.
Was there anything else about the book that you wanted to touch on today?
We have examined religion, especially the history of religion, putting northern India and northwestern part of India as the central zone. But here is a story that actually puts central India as the zone of divine zone. Like the Leela Stali of Madhura, Krishna has the Leela Stali, right? And same way, Narasimha, the central Indian mountains, the Nallamala forests are the genesis, are the central zone of activity, the Leela Stali of Narasimha. This also helps us understand the religion as something that is spread out within India as well as found in different regions, not just one divine place, one Leela Stali, but multiple Leela Stalis, as is common with India, right? Multiple gods, multiple Leela Stalis, multiple focus points. So Narasimha, the study of Narasimha also helps us understand that there is the Leela Stali of Narasimha in Middle India, in Madhya Desha.
Fascinating. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Raj. I really enjoyed and I'm thrilled and honored to be here. Thank you.